Hey, Drew.
Hey, Mark.
Not to be much of a downer for you today, but are you familiar with the Doomsday Clock?
Yes, vaguely. I think it feels to me like one of those things that came out of the era of like Doctor Strangelove and like the end of the world.
Yeah.
But like in a more serious vein.
Yeah, it's very serious. It's made by like a group of academics in like the atomics industry. And it's basically just a symbol of the likelihood of a human-made global catastrophe. And they define it that way, which I find interesting, instead of just saying like the likelihood of nuclear holocaust. But that's, you know, for the longest time, what it's sort of been a measure
of. That was like the most likely one, right?
Yeah. And, you know, but between that and climate change, it's sort of a toss up. It feels like these
it's
days.
It's going to be a photo finish.
That's
shoot for the captive ball.
That's right. So, you know, I thought, wouldn't it be fun today to talk about the Doomsday Clock? And specifically, I wanted to test your knowledge a little bit about it. You're a little bit late to target it in the Doctor Strangelove era. It actually came out, it was like released as an idea in 1947.
Oh, okay.
So very, very shortly after World War II.
Yeah, well, some people were probably already worried about it,
I think rightly so. And then, you know, right on the heels of that, right, basically the Soviet Union is having their arms race to build their own bomb, and thus, like, the need to say maybe someone should be measuring how close we're getting to the edge. So some fun trivia for you. Do you know what the Doomsday Clock, I should mention, is a current, like, it's persisted into today. And so there is still this group that measures this likelihood of how close we are to the edge of human-made global catastrophe.
New group of people, though, right?
Yeah, I mean, I assume the old ones are dead.
It's the Doomsday Clock of Theseus, right? Is it the same group?
Is it?
I don't know. Anyway, not important.
I mean, that's true then for any organization. Like, is it ever, like, is the GE of today, like, still the same GE of, like, Jack Welch's era? Like, come on.
Financially, certainly not, but.
Well, okay. Poor example.
Yeah. Anyway. Right.
Anyway, so my question for you is, what's the current clock setting? And I guess, you know, for everyone listening and for you, although I assume you're familiar with this, the way they measure it is like minutes or measurement to midnight is like the way that they designate the clock settings.
And like how close we are to midnight is like how close we are to catastrophe.
Right. Midnight is, oops, we're dead.
Oops.
Okay, so the current clock setting, do you know what it is? It was last adjusted in 2023.
Oh, wow. Okay. So I'm going to try and figure this out by like starting from the beginning. I don't know what it started at, but I want to say it was like 15 minutes to midnight. It was
incorrect, but I do have that is a separate question for you later.
Okay, well,
I've got three times I'm going to test you on.
Okay, this is not going to go well then. So I'm going to say it started sometime, you know, before midnight, and I feel like they were incrementing it in like, you know, oh, something bad happened, 1 minute closer to midnight, 1 minute closer. And they just kept doing that. And then, you know, things like Cuban Missile Crisis happened. I don't know, like all bad things continually marching 1 minute toward midnight. And then they realized like, this isn't going to work, guys. Like we got to start doing like 10 second intervals or something, because we actually haven't died yet.
Right.
There might have been a time when it went backwards, too. I don't know. Like, maybe the fall of the Soviet Union was like, okay, we gained an extra minute. I don't know. But I'm going to say that, like, when they got to five, they started doing it in more, like, smaller chunks, like, less than a minute. So, like, you know, 20 seconds, 30 seconds, whatever. But it's been progressively marching. And I'm going to say we're at 2 minutes to midnight.
You said 2 minutes to midnight.
Yeah.
No, 90 seconds. So you are correct that in recent years it has incremented in smaller amounts. This was a, I think, 10 second increment. And so the lack of progress on addressing the climate crisis and then the invasion of Ukraine by Russia advanced the clock again. And so we're currently at 90 seconds to midnight.
Okay, but it has not moved since then.
Not since 2023.
Okay.
You alluded to both of these other questions.
Okay, sorry.
So this this is great. This is great, and I like where you're thinking. The farthest it's ever been from midnight was in 1991. And it was related to both the Soviet Union dissolving, as you mentioned, and the agreement the U.S. had made with the Soviet Union called the Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty, or START, where both sides agreed to get rid of some amount of nuclear arms. It added something like, no, I'm not going to tell you how much it added to the clock because that would give you a pretty good guess. What do you think the farthest we've ever been from midnight was, and knowing that it was in 1991?
Yeah, I actually would have thought that the farthest was when it started, and it's sort of been
kind of surprising, isn't it?
Monotonically increasing, yeah, but yeah. Crazy. Okay, so the farthest was in 1991, and they moved it back some large amount that you won't tell me. Let's see. I'm going to go with 15 again. I'm going to say 15 minutes to midnight.
Closer. 17 minutes to midnight. Actually, not closer, because that's 2 minutes versus 30 seconds off.
Yeah.
17 minutes to midnight is the farthest we've ever been, which is, yeah, very, very impressive. And it makes sense when you think about the 90s really ended up being sort of an optimistic kind of decade for a lot of people because of these things.
17 right? minutes to midnight's a long time. You got time for like a McDonald's run.
Yeah. I mean,
Yeah. You could do a lot of stuff before midnight in 17 minutes, but
you could play like so many games of bullet chess. It's crazy.
Yeah. Well, I could play probably like 15 games of pinball.
Yeah. All right. So lastly, what was the initial setting on the clock?
Okay. So we already said it wasn't 15 minutes, and I know now that it has both gotten closer and farther in the meantime. So I'm going to pick 10 then this time. It seems like a nice round number.
7 minutes. They don't justify why that, why they chose that number. So it's unclear to me why it was 7 minutes to midnight in 1947, maybe because it was 1947 and then they were like, seven. Someone just like looked at a calendar.
Maybe it was like 10 minutes, but then
it very quickly, I should note, like it very quickly changed after that, because then when the Soviet Union had their like Tsar Bomba test, like very quickly were we at like 5 minutes to midnight. People were like, oh, so this, the Cold War, it's happening. Okay, great.
Yeah.
So obviously, you know, we're talking about that because, as we always do, we talk about pinball. And today I wanted to talk to you about a great pinball machine from a manufacturer we haven't seen before. And this game is called Total Nuclear Annihilation.
What a friendly theme for pinball.
I know. Let's get into it. So Total Nuclear Annihilation came out in 2017, and it was made by Spooky Pinball.
Oh, okay.
They're a manufacturer we haven't seen before on the podcast, but you have seen at least a couple of their machines, some of which I hope we get to discuss at some point. If you're a listener out there, you might have seen a Spooky Pinball machine if you've ever played Rick and Morty. Or maybe if you've seen Looney Tunes, which is their newest game out as of the time of this recording. This game was created by a guy named Scott Denisi. Or at least that's how I'm going to pronounce it. So Scott, if you're out there, I'm sorry if I'm saying your name wrong. And this machine has a really cool story. Aside from being a theme that I think is just an awesome idea for a machine, it started out as a homebrewed project.
Oh, cool.
Scott Denisi, in 2015, just had ambitions of building a pinball machine, and this is what he came up with. And then later, Spooky Pinball opted to make a production run of it because he went to different trade shows. He got featured on Dead Flip's channel on Twitch, and they saw some real promise in this game, and they wanted to make it. So in 2017, there were 500 of these made. And then in 2022, they made another release with 250 machines. So there are 750. Wow. It's a pretty small run machine.
Yeah.
And we're lucky enough that there is one close by to us that we're going to be able to check out.
That's awesome.
One of the other things that I think is really kind of cool and worth calling out, if you want to check it out after the show, is Scott made a whole blog on his website, you know, detailing the construction process to coming up with the theme, to the different code releases that he's patched and made and published out there, as well as his journey to getting it produced with Spooky. And it's a fascinating read to see, you know, this guy's journey into building his own machine to getting a production run made.
So the same guy designed kind of like the play field and wrote the code.
That's right. And he did the music. He did the sound effects. Wow. He did all of it.
Wow. Props to him. That's quite an accomplishment. That's amazing.
And you know, it's cool because you go back through the blog post and you see quite the journey that it was in terms of how long it took. And he, he says, right, in his blog that he started out making this as a basically a love letter to the old era Bally pinball machines. So he wanted to design something that had kind of a single play field and really harkened back to the design and aesthetic of an 80s machine.
Okay.
And as part of that, he then chose Total Nuclear Annihilation as a theme, as like a cyberpunk, like retro futuristic vibe, because that fits the 80s aesthetic, right? Like now the machine itself plays like an 80s machine, and now aesthetically it feels like it wouldn't be super out of place in the 80s because of the design choice he's making. So that's the idea behind Total Nuclear Annihilation.
Okay, so what makes it like an 80s machine?
Yeah, so the main idea, right, is first of all that you have a single playfield. There is no like upper playfield kind of area. There are no like big like rails coming back down to bring balls to you. Like everything is sort of self-contained.
It's like no ramps.
Yeah.
Do they have like, is there an under playfield, like a scoop or
There is a scoop for sure.
Okay.
But there's basically one objective, and the idea is you're this kind of anti-hero in the cyberpunk anti-hero in the 80s, and you're trying to destroy these different nuclear reactors. And so the gameplay loop is going to be very sort of singularly focused. There are a bunch of stand-up targets, which I feel like is very 80s kind of specific.
Okay.
And you're basically going to hit a bunch of stand-up targets to light the start of a mode, hit the scoop to start the mode. And then in the top of the play field is like this like reactor space. And it's sort of this enclosed looking area with an upper flipper that like you try and bash stuff to get the reactor to go off.
Yeah. I think that's how nuclear reactors work.
Hey, look, right? Man, I'm not a nuclear engineer. I don't know. It very well could be.
I mean, there's no way of knowing.
There's no way of knowing. I've seen the show Chernobyl, and I feel like there are a lot of standing switches. So
I think I saw a Russian guy with a hammer hitting stuff.
Yeah, so it's kind of an interesting an interesting nod to the era of Bally Pinball at, I don't know, was that their heyday, like the 80s?
Probably, yeah.
Okay. So yeah, kind of a love letter to that. So a couple of things to know about the machine. You know, I mentioned the objectives. We're trying to advance the reactor. You hit the stand-up lights to start the reactor scoop, hit the scoop to start the reactor, advance the reactor by hitting either spinners or the switches and slingshots that are in the reactor core, which is like this upper area of the play field that we'll see. And then you do that until there's going to be a display counter on what looks like a TV, like an embedded TV screen in the back of the play field, until that display counter surpasses a count of 99. Once that happens, you hit some sort of shot to blow the reactor up, and then you advance the progression, you know, that shows on the screen.
Okay.
A couple of gimmicks that are worth calling out. There are two skill shots to be aware of. One is called the hands-free skill shot. If you manage to basically hit with the plunger to where the skill shot, it's like your standard skill shot where there's like three, four slots at the top.
Oh, okay.
And if the ball drops into the lit up one, you hit the skill shot. If you hit it hands-free, because in a lot of pinball machines, if you use the flippers, you can change which channel the light is indicating.
Oh, uh-huh.
Do you know what I mean? If you hit it hands-free, so you don't use the flippers to change that shot, you get 100,000 points. You automatically complete the reactor grid, so you're ready to start the reactor mode, and it lights one of the out lanes for ball save. If you use the flipper to adjust the lane for the skill shot, the assisted skill shot, if you will, you only get 50,000 points. You don't start the reactor, but you still get the ball save lane.
Oh, that seems like a no-brainer. But
okay. Yeah, so something to look out for yeah. Sure. That's going to be something to try for. And then the other kind of neat gimmick, and as I found this out, this is the first time this has ever been done in pinball, is what is now known as the Denisi ball lock exists in this game.
Oh, wow.
And the way the ball lock works for multi-ball here is it's an inline ball lock off to the right. And what makes it unique is that it's three balls that are held in line each by their own drop target. That has apparently never been done in pinball to start a multi-ball.
Okay.
So, but as far as unlocking, as far as I can tell, you knock down the drop target and then you shoot the ball up there again and the drop target comes back up. And it's just going to trap each ball in subsequent order.
Okay.
And then hit it again, presumably to start the multi-ball.
That's pretty amazing that in the year of our Lord 2024, someone is inventing like a new thing for pinball.
Yeah, let's be clear. That was invented in like 2015.
Oh, 2015, sure.
When he did it.
Okay.
9 years ago.
Yeah. So it's pretty impressive to invent a new mechanic for pinball, especially in a machine that is like trying to be like of an older vintage.
Yeah. One thing that I also want to mention before we go play it, because I'm not sure either of us are going to be good enough to get to it. There are 9 reactors that you have to...
All of which we're trying to destroy.
Yeah. Yes, like, you're destroying reactors because you're like some...
Advance the Doomsday Clock a little bit.
I guess so, because yeah. You're an anti-hero and like, boo, nuclear power. That feels very 80s.
Yeah.
I guess. If you destroy all 9 reactors, this game has, instead of starting like a wizard mode, the game shuts off.
Okay.
And it's an intentional design choice to signify like, you have, good job, idiot, you've just destroyed the world. And so it gives you like a massive bonus, and then like the flippers die, like the entire, like everything like just kind of shuts off.
Like game over, or does it literally turn the machine off?
I don't think it literally, I think it's like game over, flippers stop. They might turn off. It's unclear to me if the lights turn off like in the play field and like just go silent. But my understanding is like everything is supposed to sort of just kind of die out.
That's
awesome. And then I think if you have any balls left, it would start like your next ball and you would still have like that big bonus paid out to you.
Oh, okay.
But
you lose a ball though.
Yeah, like it ends like, congrats, you've beat the game. Zoop.
I wonder if you could do it like on every ball and have 3 full shutdowns.
Yeah, it would be interesting to see. I haven't tried to spoil myself on what that
looks
like.
I'm sure
I'll
get it. I'm sure.
Well, maybe. Maybe. So with all of that in mind, any other questions before we go check this thing out?
No, let's go.
Let's do it. Welcome back. Talking about Total Nuclear Annihilation and also the pinball name of this pinball machine of the same name. What'd you think? Initial impressions.
I totally get what you're talking about with that like kind of 80s vintage vibe. The thing that really stands out is like, yeah, that single play field just feels old. And I was not expecting to enjoy it as much as I did. I thought that it was going to be boring, but there was a lot going on.
Yeah. I have to confess, I had that looking at it in person. I was like, oh man, is this... I don't know. Like the theme, well, spoilers, the theme looks cool.
Yeah. It looks really cool.
But I was like, I don't know, like that doesn't seem like there's enough going on. But like, yeah, that it was very surprising in how much I enjoyed coming back to it.
So I've played at a couple of these like pinball museums that have, you know, really old pinball machines from like the 30s and 40s, you know, and almost all of them have this like upper loop that you launch the ball into, kind of like a horseshoe style.
Yeah.
And it always struck me as kind of just like a boring mechanic because it would just, the ball would go up there and kind of bounce back and forth and then eventually fall down. And Total Nuclear Annihilation has that same kind of loop up there, but it works.
Yeah.
I really liked it.
I also really enjoy that, you know, up there too, they use like little flap actuators that like can trap the ball when necessary. Mm-hmm. And we'll talk about that, I think, as we get a little bit deeper into our analysis. But yeah, I think, you know, it hooks you sort of from the get-go and just the entire way it presents itself. And there is something really beautiful, I think, about a simple machine in terms of single play field, the way that it handles simple objectives. And I think we've talked about this in some past episodes where like sometimes not having a lot to do like works really well. And this is a machine that I think knows that and leans into it.
Yeah, for sure.
Also, you know, before we get into any of our kind of usual discussion points, I think it's just worth mentioning again, because it's so rare that we see it. It's awesome to see a machine that's using just like its own original kind of intellectual property. Like this idea is not like a branded something or other. It's not tied into a movie. It's not, you know, it's nothing we've seen before. And I think that lets it be really creative as well. And I like that.
Yeah, I 100% agree.
Although that said, I look at some of the artwork and one of them does look like a character from like Overwatch.
I know exactly what you're talking about. Yeah.
Tracer. Right?
Tracer on the back glass for sure. But wait, if it came out in 15, was Overwatch even out back then? I don't know. Like maybe.
That's a great question. I'm going to look it up on the fly.
Did Overwatch steal from Total Nuclear?
Maybe Overwatch stole from Total Nuclear. Well, it depends. I'd have to go back on the blog post. I think he completed it in 2015 sometime, but I'd have to go back and double check. Overwatch came out May 2016. So,
oh my gosh.
Maybe there's a lawsuit for Matt Dinesi. Okay, so as we do every time we talk about a machine, we try to evaluate them critically under kind of three different criteria that helps us identify which machines are, you know, worth your time. And, you know, we recognize we are amateur players. I'd say we get pretty decent scores. We get replays fairly often, but we're not like record setters. So like, you know, a good place to be in the pinball sphere. So when we talk about these different things, we're looking at the game design, like how well does the unique things about it function? Like how does the gameplay loop work? How do those shots kind of tie together and make sense of the theme? Then we also analyze the theme itself. Like if we're calling this Total Nuclear Annihilation, how well does the layout, the shots, the callouts all tie into making you feel like you're part of that world? And lastly, how fun is the machine? Like if you were at a bar, how often, you know, how likely are you to go seek this out to make sure that you play it? How much are you pumping money into it? And from each of those, we rank on a score of, I guess, 0 to 5, but no one's gotten a 0. So
0 would be like no pinball. Like I put quarters in and the machine just like laughed at me.
I think 0 would be like, honestly, like your first pinball, like the first pinball machine, right? Where like there were no flippers. It was just, it was basically pachinko.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. So let's start with the, I want to start with the theme on this one.
Okay.
And to kick things off, I think the theme is just absolutely incredible. I think the fact that the creator set out to make a machine that felt like an 80s era pinball machine, the theme really ties into it. Like this, if someone told me this game was released in the 80s, minus the like obviously nice like computer screen monitor in the background, I would believe it. Like the gameplay loop feels authentic to the era. I love the cyberpunk theme, and I think everything about that theme is honoring the era that it's trying to evoke.
Yeah, for sure. I love the theme. I like the music quite a bit. It's good. It's good pinball music, I feel like. And it's tied to like game events, and it, you know, gets faster when you're doing exciting stuff. I absolutely love the lights on this machine. There's so many LEDs that are just amazing and do cool like effects when you blow up a reactor or when you hit something.
And also worth noting too, like the light at the top, there's like a topper light that's like a red like siren light basically. And so like when a reactor is being attacked or like you're trying to get it to go critical, like that light is like flashing around. So one, I think that's probably cool because it maybe draws, you know, spectators, but two, like the adds to that like frantic feeling you have of like trying to complete this thing.
Yeah, it certainly did feel very tense when you had those moments of trying to destroy a reactor, especially when the reactor, I think, goes critical is what it
yeah,
is.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And you're trying to hit a couple targets that like should be pretty straightforward to hit, but like I don't do well under pressure.
Yeah,
and so it always feels like
it's to your point too, not only the lights but the music, like everything about, and there's like a big shaker motor.
Yeah,
and like,
it is this like pulsing, you know,
like the reactor is going critical. Yeah, I think all of that leads to this sense of urgency in a way that's really charming.
Yeah,
I also, you know, to the end, the fact that, you know, it's an 80s style machine with like modern touches, I do like that there's like a back screen, but I like that they use the like fake CRT TV kind of like static buzz looking.
Yeah. It's a good effect.
Things that said, you know, the sort of negative I have against it for theming, and this is so minor, is I feel like there's not like a lot of unique callouts or sounds to the machine. Everything that does exist is very theme appropriate, but like, I don't know, I guess I could use a little more variety and like things that are being called out or.
Yeah. It almost feels like one of those touches that like you don't think about until it's missing, right? Like the audible call outs and kind of just like more immersive sound effects.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's a really good way to put it. Do you have anything else on your theming notes that you wanted to cover?
Yeah, I guess this is sort of gameplay, sort of theming, but like, I loved the effect of the ball bouncing around in the reactor area. Like when it's going critical, I think that is just like so on point for, you know, a nuclear reactor going critical. It's like the ball is, I don't know, neutrons, you know, bouncing around. And it does that because there are some like, I don't know if they're pop bumpers or what up there that kind
of. There's a couple of slingshots. There's probably one to the right of the upper flipper, and then there's one above the upper flipper. So it's just those two, but they're on like a slanted angle.
Yeah, they're on like the right angle. So where if you get it into there, it starts bouncing around like kind of out of control in like a fun way. And I really like that as far as the theme. The one downside, I guess, I want to call out just because I can't be 100% positive. I feel like I really liked the back glass art and the cabinet art. And then it just felt very out of place compared to the play field, which felt kind of plain.
Yeah. Now that you say that, I think that's pretty evident. And I wonder a little bit if that's because the playfield design probably hasn't really changed from the iteration from when the creator homebrewed it. Right. And so like an easy thing for a company like Spooky to do in a production run is say, okay, great. We'll update the cabinet art. We'll update the main the back glass. And from there, you know, that really makes the theme pop, but to the detriment of the playfield. And I don't know how easy it is to reprint a playfield.
I think it'd be hard to redesign the art of the playfield, given that there are cutouts for all the lights and all of the mechanical parts. So maybe they just didn't try to do it. But that, I don't know, it felt out of place. That's it.
Yeah. On the other hand, I do think that leans into making it feel old, you know, in the way that the objectives for the reactor are just like circles with numbers in them, and then they light up different colors. And like that is.
Yeah, I didn't mind the lights. I guess it's just like I expect more graphical detail, I guess, on playfield.
Yeah. Well, I guess what would you have liked to have seen?
Maybe that like tracer character from the back glass, like blowing up something, or mushroom clouds, or like little nuclear symbols, or like a nuclear reactor building or something. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. I see where you're coming from. That makes sense. So from a theming perspective, what did you give it score wise out of five?
So I give it a 4 out of 5. I felt like overall, like you said, everything that's there is actually like pretty solid and like on brand. And like, I really love the lights. I really love the effect of the reactor going critical. Just the only thing that it was maybe a little bit of a minus for me was the kind of lack of detail in the art.
Yeah, that's fair. I gave it, surprisingly for me, a 5 out of 5. I thought, you know, I was trying to think about a while ago on one of our other episodes, you had said, yeah, I think it's in the top 20%. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where I put this. It is not the best theme of all time, but it executes on the theme in a way I see in very little other pinball machines, where the theme elevates the design and it elevates the fun factor for me. And the fact that it can do that for both of those puts it in the top 20% for me.
Yeah. I'm not going to push back on that.
Sure. All right. So then let's talk about the design elements. I think that's probably where I want to go next. And again, I'll kick us off here. The design, as I've already mentioned, you know, I think ties very well into the theme and the vibe of the machine itself. Right. So the retro aesthetic of having basically just a bunch of stand-up targets, I think is really clever. I think that ball lock mechanism, that's a bunch of drop targets, is cool. But like there are also like these modern touches, right? The actuators for the flap that traps the ball in the reactor when the reactor mode is lit. And how when the reactor is not lit, those things stay up and basically it's just a big orbit shot at that point. And I think that kind of stuff is really cool. Or having the 9-digit display that counts down your ball save, I think, is a nice like quality of life improvement that you don't see maybe in other era of pinball machines of that era, but like it still honors it.
Yeah, that's definitely a unique touch. I love what you said about the little bouncing actuators at the top of the loop. That was definitely the thing that stood out most to me of the game design as like a unique thing. Because sometimes when you hit that horseshoe loop at the top, it's going straight through.
Yep.
And other times it's getting trapped in there. And it's cool that they can control that. Because I think, you know, I talked about the old style machines where they had those same kind of bouncing pegs.
Yeah.
But they didn't control them. And so it was just always, you know, a one-way gate going in and bouncing and then falling down. But being able to switch that, I think, is just like a super cool feature.
Yeah, it's cool. And actually, for a single playfield kind of machine and effectively, there's just like the one main objective, which is just going for those reactor shots. It actually gives it like a little bit of depth of gameplay that way, where it feels like, oh, I'm not in a reactor shot. Cool. I can like go for these like sort of orbits or whatever. And it makes it feel like there's more going on maybe than there is in terms of usable space.
Yep.
That said, as far as the design goes, I think that's another real strength of it is it's a simple game, but and there's a clear progression of like what you want to be doing, hit the stand-up targets, hit the scoop, then go to the reactor, then hit the reactor kill shot. But there is a real challenge there that made me want to keep coming back to the machine. And I thought that was I don't know, just like a there's something clever about the design there that it executes in that way.
Yeah, I agree. It's definitely really fun and I think designed very well. That said, I guess the way I feel is that within the limitations that the designer chose, which is this kind of old single playfield style, it's executed very well. But like those are some pretty harsh limitations. And, you know, pinball has gotten a lot further from that era. And in the case of Total Nuclear Annihilation, I feel like it gets a little boring because there's just not a lot to shoot at. There's basically like the loop that you're shooting and a couple of stand up targets. And it feels kind of like a very repetitive game loop that I think would get old for me if I kept playing it a lot.
Yeah, it's something that I would love to see and, you know, kind of try to revisit that venue enough to like get a sense of like, is this something that would lose its novelty over time once you kind of dial in those shots? And it's not clear to me, you know, like one of the challenges that I know you and I both had in our games was the scoop when it was returning the ball to you had way too much power on it.
Like a hand cannon there.
Yeah, it was crazy. And I'm sure that's a setting that can be adjusted in that particular machine, but I don't know if that's like the default setting where it's supposed to kind of ricochet back at you pretty quickly.
I thought it was going to break the glass.
Yeah. There were a couple times where it like shot up and hit the glass. That's true. So probably that's not meant to be the default. But I wonder if, you know, you changed some of that or you made the ball save less generous. I enjoyed how generous this one was in terms of like regularly giving you ball save after things like coming out of the scoop in certain situations. I wonder if that could increase the difficulty in a way that would make it something you would come back to and not lose its shine, but
yeah,
it's hard to know.
Yeah, there's definitely room for iteration on the design, and that's a luxury that a single designer maybe just doesn't have, right? Like he doesn't have 2 years and a team of playtesters to kind of tweak things.
Yeah, sort of what's interesting is I don't remember the last time he published code changes, but like he did patch a lot. Like there are a number of versions that came out. One thing that there's two modes that I want to talk about that he came out with that are pretty cool. One is a co-op mode.
Oh, nice.
Where it's you and whoever else you get to join you on the machine, just trying to destroy all 9 reactors together. And so I think that's a real achievable way to see that kind of kill screen.
So it's like basically two games that are working towards the same objective.
Exactly.
So 6 balls instead of 3.
Yeah. Or presumably that would work all the way up through 4 players.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
But we never tried to add more than 2, so I couldn't tell you actually if the machine... No, I can't think of a pinball machine that doesn't
accommodate 4. Of course, yeah, presumably, yeah.
And then another patched release, so that was one of the patch changes. One of the other ones was a 1-core mode. And so if you wanted to get into like a competitive game against a friend, it's just you just have to destroy 1 reactor.
So is it time-based?
It's a little bit time... I think your score ends up being... time-based.
Okay.
So you get a higher payout for finishing sooner and being efficient with your shots.
Yeah, otherwise it's just about how many like slingshots can you hit before you drain.
Yeah, right. Like, yeah, and it's interesting, you know, he writes in the patch notes like this mode is meant to focus like efficiency of shots, and like it's a nice thing to see a designer do and try and think about what are fun ways to engage my audience in a way that is accessible for a lot of people.
Yeah, I like having those kind of alternate game modes, especially if somebody, you know, either owns the machine or it's on free play somewhere and you don't have to worry about, you know, wasting 50 cents or 75 cents or whatever on this experiment. You just kind of have fun.
Yeah. Yeah. So from that point of view, from a design perspective, I think this is a 4 out of 5. I think it's above average. I do think some of the limitations you talked about from just sort of choosing to emulate this era of pinball, yeah, it does sort of take away from it a little bit. But otherwise, I think this, you know, executes on its vision very, very well.
Yeah, I think those game mechanics you mentioned that we didn't get to try are very cool. And I'd like to go back and find a way to play that again for sure.
I think, by the way, I did see like a co-op toggle when I was just like mashing the flippers. I think I don't know if that's by design at the venue where we're at or if every game that's in like a pump quarters into it mode allows for it. But like,
yeah, we should check it out for sure. For me, the kind of like overriding factor on the design, though, is just that like there's this big reactor in the middle of the playfield that takes up so much space. And it feels like you really can't do a lot in it. Even though as much as I like the effect of it bouncing around in the reactor, there's like a flipper in there that feels kind of worthless. Like it doesn't it's very small.
Like a standard flipper would go better there, I think.
It felt like it didn't do much. And so you have a huge element in the middle of the play field that doesn't feel like it gives the player a lot of interesting choices.
It's true. And interestingly, it is basically, it's mostly not used until you unlock the reactor mode anyway. Like it's sort of off limits. Like because that horseshoe, you know, you'd have to do such low power to fall down in there intentionally without the reactor.
And even if you did, to what end, right?
Like points.
Yeah, I guess you'd get some points, but I doubt that it's like satisfying or worth it. Anyway, that's kind of the main downside for me. So I gave it a slightly lower score. I gave it a 3 out of 5.
Okay. One other, this is actually, I think, a segue into the fun discussion for me. So I'm going to mention it now. Like the design element of that ball lock that's unique to this game is worth mentioning, right? So it is kind of, if you had asked me ahead of time, before we went to the bar or after we had played it, I don't know how I'm trying to say this. If you had asked me if this was something that had never been seen before in pinball, I would have said, no, for sure. This ball lock has existed 1,000 places before.
It doesn't seem novel, but it is, right?
Yeah. Like, and that's sort of interesting to me. Cause even knowing it when we went into play it, like I just felt like, oh, okay. Like this is just an old style ball lock.
Yeah.
But the novel factor and the thing that, you know, reflecting back on it is, yeah, the fact that it's locking 3 balls with those drop targets is pretty unique. There are machines that I can think of that are probably older than that, that lock 1 with a drop target, but locking 3 is sort of interesting.
Yeah.
It was cute, I guess. Like it wasn't like it wasn't as big of a design element as I thought it was meant to be.
Yeah. I think fundamentally a ball lock is a ball lock, right? Like it's capturing balls. You're saving from multi-ball. And a lot of times it's not even actually capturing a ball. It's just incrementing like a number somewhere.
Yeah. Right. Well, and so that's gonna pivot into the fun section quite nicely, because as you remember, and I think we were both victims of this.
Yeah.
If one player locks 3 balls, or 2 balls, I guess it's a 2-ball lock, and then
third one will get it, I think.
Yeah. If those 2 balls are locked and then you drain, those 2 balls remain locked, which is not unusual for machines. As you mentioned, there is a way to like have a smart sensor somewhere to remember which player has locked which balls and when to release them or not.
And I feel like that's something that they've been doing for decades.
Yes. And this machine, I then think as a conscious choice, makes it possible to steal ball locks from your opponent. So we both had this happen where we had trapped 1 or 2 balls and then drained. And then the next player, the first thing you do is you target that shot and then you just get basically a free multi-ball with none of the work. And that is frustrating to say the least. Like the first time I think it was kind of funny.
It was funny. Yeah. But like for me, it's not satisfying to get it. And it's really frustrating when it happens to me where I lose a chance on a multi-ball.
Yeah. Especially because those multi-balls, you know, were some of the ways
you score the points.
We jacked our scores up.
Yeah, for sure.
So that, you know, immediately like that's like a big red flag from the fun factor, because I felt like, you know, and as a reminder, when we're evaluating the machine, we're playing together back to back.
Yeah.
Sharing, you know, I don't know what you would call that, multiplayer.
Yeah.
But when we're doing our kind of competitive games to compare each other, we do it separately so that you have all 3 balls like in rapid succession without us having to alternate who's playing. And that was smart in this case, because I would have been furious.
For sure.
If like I caught one of my comp games scores got basically negated because you stole my multi-ball. And like maybe, I don't know, maybe that's part of the point too. Like if you're in a competitive scene, maybe that's the way you're meant to play it. And then if you're in like a for the lulz game, then it doesn't matter if you're stealing multi-balls and there's like a kind of party mode element.
I'm curious if like if people are playing this in like a tournament setting, how are they doing this? Because like that feels very like against the spirit of the tournament rules. I wonder if maybe there's like a tournament mode setting, because there's no reason.
Maybe it just doesn't grant multi-ball then.
Yeah, either no multi-ball, but like there's no reason they couldn't do this kind of like virtual ball lock counter kind of mechanic.
How would you do it?
So you could capture the first 2 balls, and then the third time you hit a drop target, just like don't drop the target.
And then just treat it as like, but then if I don't have the full power, but I touched the drop target, like it wouldn't have locked it in any other circumstance. But now this player is getting treated to a lock.
I think you're right. Yeah, maybe not. I mean, maybe just every lock has to be a virtual lock then. I don't know.
Yeah, maybe in like a comp mode, Yes. Maybe it hits the, oh, what you would do is you don't lock the ball, but you launch the drop target. So hit the ball all the way in the back, let the ball fall back out, then drop target comes up for player one. Oh,
yeah. Okay, then yeah,
player,
for sure.
Player two comes out, drop all the targets.
Uh-huh. And to your point, if this guy's still cutting software updates, he could do that, and maybe he has. Maybe we don't
yeah, know. Yeah, it's true. I didn't review all the patches, and I didn't look at all the
codes. That would go a long way for me, I think, because the novelty of stealing your friend's multi-ball wears off pretty quick.
Yeah, and you know, on the flip side, though, right? The multi-ball, when you get it, and whether you get it legitimately or not, is a lot of fun. Like, it's very for frantic. Sure. It's fast. Again, to your point about the lights, like, you know, you like to say, like, you like to think, I think all multi-balls are sort of the same, but for whatever reason, this one hits the spot.
No, it's a fun one. Fun one, for sure. I enjoyed it. But yeah, that was the biggest, like, downside for me on the fun factor, was kind of that multi-ball issue.
Yeah.
I also didn't like the scoop being so powerful.
Yeah.
You know, it ball saved if you didn't catch it or whatever, which is, I guess, fine. But like, what's the point of launching it out so fast? I don't know.
Yeah, I agreed with you there. And you said it, I think, in the sort of the design scheme. But for me, like, I don't know how long the appeal is for this. Like, if this were a home collection kind of game, yeah, once you figure it out, I don't know how long you're sticking with it. But on the flip side, I do feel like this is a fun enough machine that every time I go to a venue with it, I'm going out of my way to play. Like, if I had one machine that I could play while we were at that bar, it's going to be that one.
Yeah. I don't know that it's always going to be my top machine at any location, but I'd play it again. I thought it was fun.
Yeah. I guess that's, you know, I would seek it out, but right. I guess maybe if I went to a place that had like all top tier machines, then it's a tough choice.
Yeah.
So what'd you give us on a fun factor? Then?
I gave it a 3 out of 5.
3 out of 5. Pretty average.
Yeah.
And once again, I'm just above. I think it's 4 out of 5 here for me. I don't know, man. Maybe I'm just an old soul. I just like those 80s era machines.
Yeah.
So as we do with every machine, as I alluded to, we play some warm-up games, and then we do compete to see who had the highest score for the day. I want to say this one felt close. I don't remember how we shook out, but my highest score of the day was 488,211. Now, before you share yours, I actually think this is another kind of nice little touch here. This is not a huge score machine.
No.
And I like that because that feels also pretty authentic to the era it's emulating. Mm-hmm. And again, I can't remember if we've had this conversation on the podcast or not, but like, I think part of that is like literally like an integer like buffer.
Yeah, the computer cannot count higher than like, you know, 3 million or something like that.
Yeah. Right? Back. Well, obviously this one I'm sure could, but like, yes, I like that. They honor that touch. Anyway, so 488,211.
Yeah, it was very close. And as you've mentioned, I don't think either of us were setting any records. We didn't put any scores up on the machine or anything. I think I destroyed 2 reactors, maybe 3.
I think I got 2. I know you destroyed more than me. So if I got 2, I think you got 3.
I maybe made some progress on the third then. I don't know. I did 521, 812. So 521,000.
That's a good game. 12. And, you know, I think thanks to our efforts, we stave off nuclear annihilation for another day.
Yeah. By not destroying nuclear reactors.
That's right. We're doing our part.
Yeah. You know, I guess my closing thoughts on that are just that it feels kind of awkward to be like the cause of nuclear annihilation rather than trying to like fight against it. That was really weird. So I felt like in the case of, you know, total nuclear annihilation, the only winning move is not to play.
Greetings, Professor Falcon. How about a nice game of chess?